Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. David Gelernter is a famed computer visionary who has long been making waves in the world of high technology. In a new book, he moves firmly into the world of the spirit and Judaism. The best ideas we have, says Gelernter, come from Judaism. He wants everybody, you, to understand it as he sees it, lives it. Because Judaism, he says, is the most important intellectual development in Western history and possibly the world's. This hour, On Point, David Gelernter on Judaism as a way of being. You can join the conversation. Are you open to the insight Gelernter offers? Are you already there? And what's your question on Judaism? What have you found? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from North Haven, Connecticut, is David Gelernter. He's a professor of computer science at Yale and a major technology guru. He's credited with foreseeing the rise of the Internet, massive parallel processing, and much more. In 1993, he was targeted by the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski, with a nail bomb that tore into his right side. He survived with serious injuries. He's emerged as a prominent neoconservative writer and contributing editor at the Weekly Standard. And he paints images he finds central to Jewish life. His new book is Judaism, A Way of Being. David Gelernter, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for being here. It's not often that we give an hour over to a discussion of religion, but with your background and your focus here, we just found it compelling right now, and I hope we can dive in. An hour is not much time for a lifetime of study. We understand that.
But, fair enough.
But I hope you'll wade straight in with us, and we'll harvest what we can.
I'd love to.
Great. I want to begin with just a sense of your perspective on the whole question, the whole issue. On page one of Picturing Judaism here, chapter one, you call Jews the senior nation of the Western world. And as a starting point, what do you mean by that?
When I say the senior nation of the Western world, it's neither an accomplishment nor a point of pride particularly. It's a matter of historical fact in terms of the continuity of national cultural religious traditions, sense of being, sense of identity as a nation. There is no nation in the West that dates to classical antiquity, pre-classical antiquity. If we're talking about the origins of Israeli settlements, we are in the late Bronze Age in 1200 BCE. So this is an unbroken record of continuity, and I think the Jewish nation needs to honestly face the fact that it is the senior member here, which gives it certain responsibilities and certain duties, and I think we need to the Jewish nation needs to acknowledge them.
You've written the book for Jews to understand Judaism, but more widely than that. And I guess the case is made for all to understand in your assertion that Judaism is in effect, the most, as you call it, the most important intellectual development in Western history. If that's so, everybody needs to understand. It's a big claim at the same time. How do you make it?
Well, I think everybody does understand it, although most people do implicitly without thinking of it. Judaism, insofar as it gave rise to Christianity, especially in its English, North European, Puritan, and Anglican versions, insofar as it gave rise to the idea of a free and democratic modern nation, the modern liberal nation traces its roots right back to the Hebrew Bible. America is a fundamentally biblical nation, was created by pilgrims devoted to the Bible. I think all of Western civilization lives in this intellectual and spiritual world, the world in which, although you may not succeed, you understand that it's right to try to love your neighbor as yourself, a world in which, given Judaism's stunning revelation, as it seemed to Jews and the Jewish nation and in old times, of the existence of one God. If there is one God, that one God must be everybody's God. Everybody must have the right to say, this is my God. and therefore one God suggests one man. Judaism invents the idea of mankind as a single entity, as a single family, mm-hmm. as a single brotherhood, and these ideas underlie everything we have achieved, virtually everything we've achieved in thousands of years of moral and spiritual struggle.
And an essential kind of universalism in that. But when you lay out the big four themes, and we'll look at them here, that you dive into around Judaism, the very first theme you put under, there's that universalist foundation, but you describe separation. Separation is the title of your very first treatment of a theme. Separation of Jews, why?
Well, the most important aspect of separation is separation of holy from profane. The idea that rather than letting life whiz by without taking much notice, certain things, certain moments, certain sights, certain achievements, certain times are to be set aside for the purpose of stopping and looking around and saying, I am alive. This is the most precious gift that God has ever created. Let me stop and count my blessings and see what's going on. The separation of sacred time from holy time, sacred time from profane time, the idea of different textures of time emerges in the idea of the Sabbath, which is central to Judaism, to practicing Jews once a week stop doing everything they ordinarily do. They stop answering the phone. They stop driving. They stop doing work. They stop. This separation, this creation of sanctity, of sacred time, which exists in many forms throughout Jewish practice, is the fundamental thing you do when you are a Jew, set certain times apart.
There's holy from profane, and I think anyone could understand that. You also write about Judaism calling on Jews themselves to be separate.
Absolutely, and this is it's too bad Judaism isn't simpler. Its foundational ideas are simple, but Judaism is a balancing act. It's grappling with reality rather than asserting some universal principles that are difficult to grasp. So Jews have to balance the fact that on the one hand they are part of mankind, they are engaged with mankind, they are specifically enjoined to teach mankind to look for God and to search for sanctity and to reverence life. On the other hand, they're not going to be able to do that unless they exist as an entity, unless they exist as a nation, unless they cohere. The coherence of Jewish life, the fact that Judaism, the Jewish nation has always existed as a thorn in the flesh of Western civilization, preaching biblical principles, preaching the idea of seeking justice, loving mercy, and walking humbly with your God. Jews have always been hated for that. Jews have been targets from antiquity to yesterday and today. But nonetheless, Jews have this mission, they have this duty, and they will not fulfill their duty unless they make themselves an entity, unless they see themselves as an entity, no matter how scattered physically or geographically. They have to be one spiritual entity to do the job.
A fascinating tension there, because as you point out, there's often been isolation, anti-Semitism that enforced isolation, but at the same time you're describing a kind of imperative of some willful separation by this community itself.
Absolutely. Jews are told to be clanny, to keep together, to marry other Jews. And they're told that in specific defiance of human nature. I mean, the natural desire of every Jew is to be like everybody else, just as everybody else's desire is. A person doesn't want to be different. A person doesn't want to stand out. A person doesn't want to be a target. A person doesn't want to be confined to within a particular community. But the Jews are told, you've been given a mission and you have successfully carried it out insofar as you've turned the conversation again and again to the idea of sanctity, the idea of goodness, the idea of justice, the idea of fairness. And therefore, for the sake of these sacred ideas, you must do what is more unnatural than anything else, which is to be different. Nobody wants to do it. It's murderously hard, but Jews are commanded to do it, and they have done it and still do it.
Is there a tension between the universalism you began discussing and the sort of imperative of separation?
Yes, absolutely there is. Jews have Jews have a view of the world in which it is not their mission to make everybody a Jew. Jews are not a proselytizing group. They don't try and make converts. They don't try and convince other people to stop doing what they're doing and become Jews. As far as they're concerned, the obligations, the duties, the complexities, for that matter, of a Jewish life are incumbent upon those who are born Jews and those who become Jews, those who accept Judaism. But as the prophets say, every nation will walk with its God, and as for us, we will follow the Lord, our God of Israel forever. So Judaism invented the idea of tolerance, of acceptance. It says in the Bible, you shall love the stranger because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You know what it was like. Jews are commanded to not to enforce their views on other nations, but to preach to them, to be obnoxious, to teach, to be in everybody's face, never to force anybody to do what he doesn't want, never to convert people, but to insist on principles of justice and of mercy. And again, to do that requires a degree of painful separation, while at the same time the message assumes that the idea of mankind is the most sacred idea that exists, the idea that a human being is a human being, and we are not to forget that despite whatever national, superficial, ethnic differences exist.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with computer visionary painter, thinker, David Galanter, about his bold new explication of Judaism, what it means to be a Jew. David Galanter joins us from North Haven, Connecticut. You've got big themes here on the role of ritual in Judaism, on gender and sex roles and family life in Judaism, what you call the hardest by far issue, the deepest problem of any religious believer, you write, is facing is the question of evil in light of God's justice. You were famously and sadly hit by the Unabomber back in 1993, really tore you up with the bomb that exploded in your office there. You've had direct experience of a pretty evil kind of attack. Does that inform the way you look at this question of injustice and evil in the world through the prism of Judaism?
It doesn't really. I was lucky and debtor to my parents and grandparents for rearing me as a Jew and an American, confident and satisfied with who I was. And one needs exactly that kind of spiritual strength that obviously other people draw from other religions. But one needs that spiritual strength when one faces the catastrophes and miseries of life, which so many people do. I mean, I did in a rather spectacular way, but it's hardly unusual to be faced with tragedy or disaster or pain or suffering. That is the condition in which we all live.
But whether it's in the story of Job or in the story of Abraham commanded to sacrifice his son, or in the Holocaust, or in your own story, you describe the response, I don't know if you'd say prescribed or required by Judaism, as inward pilgrimage. What do you mean by that?
In the Bible, the Hebrew Bible has a somewhat strange theme running beneath the surface. It's strange or unexpected. We know about its moral content. We know about its narrative. We know about its poetry, which underlies all of Western poetry. But there's an underlying theme in which the heroes of the story, the successive heroes of the narrative, the patriarchs and Moses and the kings of Israel and the prophets, don't know who they are, struggle to understand who they are and what is their mission in life, why they are here, why are they living, what are they expected to do. And the Bible repeatedly shows us what I call in the book epiphany as theophany, a moment of epiphany, of personal revelation, of understanding who you are and what you are all about, is identified in the Bible with a moment in which you feel God's presence, which you find God. So again and again, a classical case being Moses, who's reared as an Egyptian, but knows he is a Jew, who goes out among his people, sees an Egyptian torturing, beating a Hebrew, and strikes him down, is then a wanted and hunted man for having killed this Egyptian, runs away, doesn't know who he is. Is he Egyptian? Is he a Jew? What is he, a Midianite? He's run away to Midianite. What is he supposed to do? The Bible says he wanders through the wilderness. He wanders alone through the wilderness. At last he comes to the revelation of the burning bush, and the burning bush lights up for Moses not merely the presence of God in the universe, but who he is, what he must do. That it's not enough for him to mourn the conditions of his brothers in Egypt. That won't do. He's got to do something about it. He has to personally, although he doesn't feel it in him, he's not an aggressive type of man. He's not an articulate man. He's a shy and retiring man. But he personally has to go and confront the greatest emperor in the world and lead his and tell him, let my people go. He understands that as his own mind, as his own conscience at the same time as he meets this phenomenon of the bush that keeps burning and won't go out, which the rabbis have always regarded as a symbol of Judaism itself, the passionate intensity of Judaism, the torturing intensity of Judaism, the humility or the smallness, the puniness of the Jewish nation itself. The burning bush is a thorn bush in Hebrew, specifically the lowest and sort of least significant of bushes, and yet it blazes with light and won't go out. It keeps burning.
David Galanter is with us. His new book is Judaism, A Way of Being, and we want to learn more from its pages. We have a lot of callers with us as well. Let me go to Joe in Boston. Hi, Joe. You're on the air with David Galanter.
Hi. My question for David is, as a college student, I did a lot of Holocaust studies, and I made a point of asking. I just felt compelled to ask each survivor that we talked to in our classroom discussions whether they'd maintain their faith through such horrific experiences. And you mentioned that defining point, that epiphany. They all seemed, save one out of probably at least a dozen, had lost their faith during the Holocaust, and they all could point to one incident at which their faith was lost. You know, something happened that somebody got killed or selected for death or something like that, and that was it. They had lost their faith. And I was just kind of curious what your thoughts were related to the Holocaust, as it's such a defining moment in modern Jewish history. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. David?
Well, it's a tremendously important question, and I think there are several things one has to note. The reaction of Elie Wiesel has become in some ways characteristic or symbolic. And, of course, he was a survivor of Auschwitz and as a young man wrote of the destruction of his faith. He was raised as an observant Jew. He lost his faith at Auschwitz, and it was a particular moment, as you say. In later years, as he grew older and as far as he was concerned, more experienced and wiser, he regained it in a different way, a sadder and a wiser way, as he's described it. Eliezer Berkowitz, another death camp survivor, writes in a remarkable classic book called With God in Hell about the fact of many Jews in the death camps abandoning, having been reduced to the to bestial conditions of suffering and starvation. He says, naturally, most of my fellow Jews had no thought except to live from one minute to the next. He says, Judaism expects nothing more of tortured people. However, he says, I was inspired. My life was changed by meeting and knowing people in the death camps who insisted on maintaining their connection with Judaism and maintaining their ongoing, often bitter argument with God. But he says, when I saw people who insisted on maintaining their Jewish faith and whose Jewish faith kept them together, kept them intellectually together, even to the moment when they were tortured to death, Eliezer Berkowitz says, having seen that, I myself can never lose my faith in God. I've seen God go halfway, more than halfway, to meet sufferers and sustain them in their suffering, while at the same time I could never condemn, I could never question those who lost their faith. It's an ambivalent reaction as it has to be in fairness to the profundity of the event.
As big as it gets and as hard. Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah. Let's see how far I can wade into all this slop speak before I get cut off. One, the Jews were not the first to promote justice nor to discuss justice in length. The ancient Greeks and Romans did exactly the same thing. Most civilizations at the time discussed what is and is not the concept of justice. Number two, the ancient Jews were not tolerant of other religions. You have only to read the Old Testament and the arrogance of we are the chosen, you are not, is prevalent throughout most of the Old Testament. Number three, the United States, as well as most of Western civilization, is not due to Judeo-Christian thought. It's due to the Enlightenment, which refuted a lot of Christianity and refuted a lot of Judaism. And number four, you have only to look at modern-day Israel to get some feel as to what exactly the Jewish brand, or shall we say the Israeli brand of intolerance, can possibly be. You mentioned Elie Wiesel. Yes, he's a force when it comes to talking about morality. But boy, does he have one hell of a blind spot when it comes to talking about the atrocities that Israel commits and has committed. He becomes very legalistic when he starts talking about Israel. I think we should put this whole thing in perspective. Yes, there was a Jewish and is a Jewish contribution to the world, but they are not preeminent when it comes to contributing to the Western thought.
Bill, thank you very much for your call and thoughts. David Glernter, how do you respond?
Well, this sounds just like many of my colleagues at Yale who were raised in blinders and taught lies. The lie of Israeli atrocities, I don't know if you've ever been to Israel, it sounds as if you haven't. The lie of Israeli atrocities is the same big lie that has been argued against Jews and is an excuse for the slaughter of Jews back to Roman times, and certainly the Nazi big lie about the awful behavior of the Jews and their intolerance and all the rotten things they did when Jews were struggling their very hardest to live up to their principles, as the Israeli army does, as I say with profound pride. There is no army that has ever struggled as hard as the Israeli army has done, that has taken so many casualties to preserve the lives of civilians on both sides of the fight. You don't know the facts. Go to Israel and look around.
But of course, we have seen a lot of killing on both sides in that conflict. It's not as though there haven't been guns out of control in that very difficult situation for a long time.
Yeah, Tom, but the fact that there's disagreement does not mean that we don't have an obligation to judge right and wrong. You have to remember the many Englishmen and Frenchmen in the 1930s who said, well, we disapprove of Hitler's vulgar anti-Semitism, but after all, the Jews have done a lot of rotten things too, and they do own all the banks. Well, they don't own all the banks, but they own one or two banks. They own all the newspapers. Mm-hmm. They don't actually own all the newspapers. I mean, the fact is this idea of – this is exactly what the Bible will not accept, what is unique to the Jews in their mission. They will not accept indifference. They will not accept standing back, washing your hands of the argument and say a plague on both your houses. That's just not good enough. No man is perfect. No nation is perfect. No army is perfect. Jews are the last to claim perfection. They beg for forgiveness of their sins as a nation every year and as individuals every day. But nonetheless, they won't allow you not to judge. They insist you have to grapple with the facts and learn the facts.
Bill put a lot on the table. What about the whole dynamic of the chosen people and the pushback that is found? You hear Bill calling it arrogance. In your thinking about Judaism, how do you look at this piece?
The fact that the Jewish nation is chosen emerges from history. It's a fact of history. We would call the Jewish nation chosen. Certainly not in a sense which they themselves would like. Obviously, the Jewish nation is chosen when we look at the way they have obsessed this tiny group of people have obsessed human society and human evil since antiquity. Why should the Romans have made such a big deal of the need to conquer a tiny little nation like Israel and destroy its temple? Why should medieval Christianity have been obsessed with converting and destroying the Jews? Why should Stalinist Russia and so many communist regimes and Nazi Germany have been obsessed by this tiny group of Jews who were doing their best to be good citizens and obsessed with the need to destroy them? And why today is the UN obsessed with Israel? Is there no other evil-doing, evil-tolerating nation? You would think from the agenda of the UN that Israel is a unique specimen of evil.
But what's your answer to the question? Is it related to the chosen people status or something else?
Nobody wants to hear the truth. It's related to the fact that the Jews insist on speaking the truth, on speaking of the need for justice, on speaking of the demand for justice to everybody, poor as well as rich, weak as well as powerful. Nobody wants to hear that message. Honestly, we have other things to do with our lives. We don't want to hear the prophets telling us, don't live just to get rich. Don't live just to enjoy yourself. You have other obligations, but nobody wants to hear that message. The Jews as a nation have proclaimed it have been obsessed with it and have aroused the hostility, which we see in a sense in the Christian image of the crucified Jesus, the Christian idea of mankind having grieved the presence of God with a desire to murder him, the Jews having spoken again and again of the imperative to seek justice and love mercy, have said things nobody wants to hear and have been picked out for persecution and murder again and again until today.
Is there a truth that's championed by Jews? It's a small but, on the other hand, big population. I mean, you're a political conservative. There are many Jews who are liberal. I saw somewhere here 70% of American Jews voted for Barack Obama. I assume you did not. Is there a truth with that kind of span of outlook on politics, let's say?
Is there a truth to Judaism? If there is a truth to Judaism, it is, in the words of the prophet, to seek justice, love mercy, and walk humbly with your God, to balance justice with mercy. Or if there is a truth, it is equally the verse in Leviticus, which says, "Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself." Now, these are foundational truths of Judaism. They have become foundational truths of Christianity and of Western civilization. Judaism invented them. The ancient Greeks did not. That is false. They emerge from the Bible. And nonetheless, there is a widespread – when we talk about politics, when we talk about conservatives, when we talk about Barack Obama, Judaism is not an ideological line. I mean, Judaism is fundamentally a texture of time. To borrow a phrase from the great novelist Nabokov, who uses it in his masterpiece, Ada, a texture of time, a unique texture of time, a way of being is what Judaism teaches. It doesn't teach you to be a conservative or to be a liberal. It teaches you to have certain principles which have been associated with liberals. It insists on tolerance, on fairness, on equal judgment, on social justice. The idea of social justice was invented by the prophets of the Hebrew Bible. But at the same time, it insists on love and loyalty for your ancestors, your family, your parents. Those are conservative principles.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with David Galanter about his bold new explication of Judaism and what it means to be a Jew. He's a professor of computer science at Yale University, a computer visionary, widely hailed, a painter. The visual is very important to his understanding of Judaism, and a wide thinker, a conservative, a neoconservative, a columnist for the Weekly Standard, contributing editor there. He joins us today from North Haven, Connecticut. We've got lots of calls. Let's go to Stowe, Vermont, and Wendy. Wendy, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. I moved to Stowe, Vermont from Brooklyn, New York, and previous to from Long Island. Extensive Jewish education. when I was 12 years old, 1972, when I was bar mitzvahed, I pretty much walked away. I felt that it wasn't anything I could relate to. And as a woman, then a girl, I felt that it was something that I did not have a place in. But I grew up with the edict, never marry outside your religion. And I thought it was my responsibility to repopulate the world with Jewish children after the Holocaust. I know it's strange, but this was something I was told again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And so I grow up, and I meet a man. I fall in love. He is not Jewish. We marry. We move to Stowe, Vermont, because for me, I needed to live in a community where there were many Jews, and there's a Jewish center in Stowe, Vermont. And it is my own children, my boys now bar mitzvah age, who drag me back into the Jewish community. All of this sounds so conflicted, which I had been. I am now teaching religious school. I read and write Hebrew, and I am looking forward to their bar mitzvahs, and I belong to the Jewish community of Greater Stowe. It is not a temple per se, but like-minded people who are very attracted to the spirituality of the religion and what it can teach us in our daily lives.
Wendy, we hear the in and out, the back and forth there. Does it bring you to a question for David Galanter?
Well, for me, right now, I am trying to reconcile my role as a woman within the Jewish community. My brother's girlfriend, an African-American and a Jew, is sending me a book about the five books of Miriam and not Moses. And I am on my quest to find where I am spiritually as a woman in the Jewish community. When we read the Parshas, the last one was about buying Leah and Rachel as wives. So we're still teaching our children about where women stand as as property, but yet, of course, we know that's not the case.
Wendy, let us pick it up, if you would. David Galanter writes a lot about this in a chapter called Perfect Asymmetry, and you raise the question, David. You say, in its public ceremonies are conducted by males. It seems Judaism, normative Judaism, seems to be religion for men. You ask, is Judaism prejudiced against women? Share your answer with us.
Well, it's an important question, and the kind of conflicts we've heard from Wendy are deeply characteristic, and I think are good. They show a kind of a sense of spiritual responsibility that I think many Jews feel, despite the fact that they aren't necessarily at home in Judaism, they don't necessarily find what they want there, but they don't feel themselves free to just chuck it. And there are many people who have emerged as leaders of the community. Before I speak briefly of women, mm-hmm. the Jewish community has always been a community of arguers, a community of argument. Jews are not expected to agree with each other or all to accept the same principles, all to accept the same interpretations of the Bible of Judaism. In fact, they're specifically expected not to. If you open any page, literally any page of the Talmud, you'll discover arguments, disagreements, disputes. In fact, some of the most famous passages in the Bible are arguments with God, Abraham's famous argument with God, in which he accuses, he said, shall the judge of all the earth not do justice, in mm-hmm. which he is struggling with the question of evil. So argument within the community, disagreement within the community, argument with God, and yet ultimate spiritual unity of purpose is what characterizes Judaism, not unanimity. There has never been an enforced dogma or a standard of right thinking in Judaism as there has been in other religions. Judaism's view of women is, of course, not the Bible's view of women. There are great female heroines in the Bible, and needless to say, males play the leading role because the Bible is a faithful record of late Bronze Age and early Iron Age society. I mean, among other things, it's a ruthlessly realistic piece of work. It's all about human nature. It's all about human society as it existed at the time, and certainly Jewish views are very different from what they were in the Bronze Age. But it remains the case that as far as Judaism is concerned, men and women are different insofar as they have different bodies, they have different minds also. The world is stronger when it's made of two different components than it's made of components that are all the same. I mean, if you take concrete and reinforce it with steel, you get something that's better than either concrete or steel. Rather than having men and women be copies of each other, Judaism gives them different roles. Judaism sees the world as divided into public and private, more or less on the order of the ancient temple in Jerusalem, the two temples, which had outer plazas and inside at the very center a holy of holies, which the second temple was a perfectly empty cube, which fascinated the whole world at the time, challenged in a sense the whole world. But as far as Judaism is concerned, men have the prime responsibility for running things in the public sector. Women have the primary responsibility for running things in the private sector, in the family, in the home. Judaism unambiguously rates the home as more important, unambiguously rates the woman's role as more essential. If you're a Jew, there's no obligation to go to synagogue. It's a nice thing to do. It's encouraged. But if you don't, okay. But the rituals of the home, the holiness of the home, the education of children, the way you create sanctity in the home, this is the prime responsibility of women. Men are allowed to do it if there are no women, just as women are allowed to officiate if there are no men in public.
Does that mean a woman's place is in the home is sort of is the view without apology? Is that what you're saying in effect?
Exactly, without apology. And when we forget how vastly more important the home is than your career, than your job, the way you make money, the way you interact with your business associates or whatever, when we turn into a careerist society rather than a society that cares about the rearing of children in the care of parents, we tip off the edge of Judeo-Christianity and wind up in a secular paganism which is spiritless and profoundly depressing, morally depressing.
Can contemporary women then not have careers without abandoning Judaism as you see it? Does it make them pagans?
No, of course they can have careers. And Jewish women have been leaders in having careers, and many Orthodox Jewish women have careers. There's nothing in Judaism against women having careers or men having careers. It's just that Judaism doesn't regard them as terribly important. Judaism is just not going to get excited about the fact that you're making $400,000 2 years out of college. It really doesn't care. That not caring is extended to the fact that women who want to have jobs are encouraged to do so. Every Friday evening, every Friday night at the beginning of the Sabbath, we recite a poem called Eshes Chayel, Heroic Woman or Woman of Valor, describing the ideal female type, as it were, who's a noble and loyal wife and mother, and who also is a businesswoman who acts in the community, who boldly says what is right and speaks truth and speaks wisdom. This is a very active, in fact, an aggressively active view of women. But it is also the case that just as if you are a man, you have certain responsibilities in synagogue. When you are in synagogue, you are responsible. You have a duty to do certain things. Similarly, if you are a woman, if you are a mother at home, you have responsibilities to do certain things, such as to light candles on the Sabbath and create thereby with a profoundly powerful and semi-mystical act the sanctity that should pervade the home on the Sabbath. So yes, there is a difference. And yes, Judaism is proud of believing that the home is vastly more important than the public arena.
Let's take a call from Salt Lake City in Utah. Eric, you're on the air with David Galanter.
Yeah, hi, David. My name's Eric. It's all very interesting what you're saying. I'm going to speak a little bit from an Eastern perspective. I've been studying the Gaudiya Vaishnavism for about 6 years, which is the Hare Krishna movement, and I was really impressed what you said earlier when you were talking about how Judaism has a foundation in everybody being connected under one God, and that's one of our founding foundations as well, which is that there's one God and we're all spirit souls, human beings and, of course, animals and plants alike. And if the world were to take that as a perspective, I think the world would be a much more peaceful place. I guess my question is have you, when you're in your research, have you looked into some of the Eastern philosophies such as the Hare Krishnas and Gaudiya Vaishnavism in your research? And I just wanted to kind of get your perspective on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. David.
Thank you. I wish I knew more than I did. I've always been fascinated by the many varieties of Hinduism and by the many varieties of Buddhism, and also by their aesthetic implications, which are extraordinary. But I can't agree with a part of the Hindu worldview that says we're all one, mankind, animals, plants. As far as Judaism is concerned, this isn't so. Human beings are different. They have moral responsibilities. They can be held responsible. No animal, no plant has a duty to love its neighbor or to treat animals kindly, which is one of the most important imperatives of Judaism, or to seek justice or to love mercy. These are uniquely human responsibilities. And for a human is an animal, but for a human to live like an animal, for a human to sink into the bestial existence, which is characterized the most vicious totalitarianisms of the last century, is not acceptable from Judaism's point of view. Judaism loves nature, insists on man's responsibility of kindness to animals as one of the most important of all moral obligations, but also insists that human beings must understand that they're different, they're separate.
What about multiculturalism more broadly? Eric raises it with a sort of an Eastern spiritual view there. You're rather critical of it, at least in terms of putting everything on the same plane. If I read you correctly, you're saying no, and maybe this is a precept of Judaism, but you have to judge. And if you judge, some are better than others.
Absolutely. Judaism insists that it is the moral responsibility of adulthood to judge. It says in the Talmud, do not judge another man until you've been in his place. You're required to judge carefully. It's understood that you may reach wrong judgments, and then you'll have to bear the responsibility. That's what it is to be an adult.
How does that sit with a multicultural age, David, in a time when, people of so many faiths and backgrounds live together cheek by jowl?
Well, there's a dramatic difference between saying we will follow our God and we insist on doing right as we see it, and I'm saying on the other hand, our goal is to make the whole world Christian or to make the whole world Muslim or to make the whole world anything. And Judaism shares with some Eastern religions, an opposition to proselytism, an opposition to Certainly to converting people by force, but not even to converting them by persuasion. That's not the way Judaism deals with the world. One of the most important verses in the Bible, which says, apply your own experience. You must be kind to strangers because you are strangers yourselves. You know what it's like. Tolerance is a Jewish idea and emerged in this country from the biblical community.
Let's go to Kathy in Watertown, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi. Excuse me, I have a cold. I'd like to comment on an earlier caller who was remarking about the disconnect between the principles that are in the Bible and the actualities, especially the situation in Israel with the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
And your guest said that obviously that person had not been there and didn't know that Israel had the most just army in the world. Well, number one, I'm Jewish. Number two, I have been there. And I will tell you that all of the commentary about how people should behave has been thrown out the window by the government and the military of Israel. And I have seen it with my own eyes. I'm not stupid. All you have to do is go through the separation wall, which is an apartheid wall, and see the miserable condition of Palestinians who are Muslims and Christians, and see what is being done to them by the occupying army of Israel.
Kathy, we've got the gist, and our time is very short. Thank you for calling, David. How do you respond?
It's always been the curse of Jews that the most vicious haters of the Jewish community have often been Jews themselves.
Why is Kathy not a defender of justice?
Well, if we were to talk about the about Israeli politics and political reality on the ground, is really a very separate issue from the nature of Judaism. But I don't doubt her sincerity. She's wrong on the facts. And how do you learn the facts? It's not by talking to an Israeli or being an Israeli. It's by living in Israel. It's by living with Israelis. It's by studying what comes out of Israel and understanding that the big lie, which has often been practiced by Jews against their own people, that the big lie has been part of civilization's war against the Jews, going back to the blood libels of the Middle Ages, going back to Roman antiquity, going forward to the Nazis and the Stalinists. The big lie is the way that civilization has dealt with a people who it doesn't want to hear, it doesn't want to listen to.
But these are their perceptions of a fellow Jew, and nevertheless, you would paint them as part of a big lie?
I'm afraid so. I wish it weren't true, and I respect her sincerity. I think she's wrong on the facts.
David Galanter. You can read an excerpt from Judaism, A Way of Being, at our website, onpointradio.org. David Galanter, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.